Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. We are in Nahum chapter 3, looking at verses 1 through 7. If you look on the front page of the notes, there are four, we mentioned this last week, there's four descriptions of Nineveh's overthrow. The first two were in chapter 2, and we're looking at the third and fourth one in chapter 3. Tonight we're looking at the third one, which is chapter 3, verses 1 through 7. It's the third description of the battle. And so they're going to have descriptions of the invasion, but then there's also going to be descriptions of the character of Nineveh, of why. This is the invasion, and this is why the invasion is taking place. So they're announcing the judgment and the battle that's going to take place. And one of the things that's going to be brought up here at the end, in the last verses 5, 6, and 7, is the rapid decline, even historically recorded, the rapid decline of Nineveh. Realizing that Tiglath-Pileser, Shalmaneser were doing a great job of building an empire, conquering the world, if you would, organized. They had systems in place. Even Sargon, who destroyed or finished destroying Israel in the north of Samaria, followed by Sennacherib, who had a great empire, built a great palace, a great empire, threatening Judah and Hezekiah in 701 B.C., and continuing on down into his son's reign, Esarhaddon, and Ashurbanipal, who is one of the great kings of this whole dynasty, or this whole reign, during his first 20 years, from 668 to, say, 648, or until about the time of Nahum, Ashurbanipal was still expanding, still conquering, known as the great king, had great monuments. But then right around this time, suddenly, just as Nahum was speaking, this thing, the Assyrian Empire, goes into decline, and by 612, it's devastated. It's very clear, I don't want to say very clear, to the Christian, to the believer, it's very clear it was a divine intervention. As surely as it was saving Nineveh in Jonah's day, saving Assyria from destruction, and Nineveh from destruction in Jonah's day was God's intervention. This right here, he just turned the tables on them, and it collapsed. Now, if you step into the secular view of what historians see, what archaeologists see, they can see the same thing as far as a tremendous turnaround, a sudden turnaround of the sudden decline of the Assyrians. And that's kind of interesting because we have this book, Nahum, prophesying this sudden turnaround, and we have facts that attest to it. So nonetheless, we're in chapter 3. I'll read the first seven verses in the NIV, then we'll go to the notes and break some things down and try and draw some things out of what God is saying to Nineveh and how the destruction is going to take place. Chapter 3, verse 1. Woe to the city of blood, full of lies, full of plunder, never without victims. That describes the sin. Then here in verse 2 and 3, you're going to hear the invasion. And as we read this, remember, I've got the map on there for you of the city of Nineveh. Here, again, we drew it last week, something like this. You got the river coming through the city, matching up with the Tigris River out here. Right in this area is the walled palace and temple area. Sennacherib's palace is here. Right next to it would be Sennacherib's is here, and Ashurbanipal's is right here. That's the man that is ruling while this is being written. And then there's temples in this area. When they start talking about chariots, imagine they have breached this wall, the city wall of Nineveh, which was very large, and they're running through these streets, destroying it, and the elite are here in the fortified palace area, which is itself very large. Chapter 3, verse 2. The crack of whips, the clatter of wheels, galloping horses, and jolting chariots. Charging cavalry, flashing swords, and glittering spears. Many casualties, piles of dead, bodies without number, people stumbling over the corpses. That's describing, again, what's taking place right here. You can see the people stumbling would be the invaders coming through. There's so many dead bodies laying around. And now verses 4, 5, and 6 are going to describe, or 4 and 5 are going to, or 4 is going to describe the details of their sin. You're going to see that words are going to be harlot or prostitute and sorcery. And these are two things that are going to be used to draw people and manipulate people. And this is describing, excuse me, the nature of this kingdom right here is what they've been doing. It says, all because of the wanton lust of a harlot, and the harlot is Assyria, alluring the mistress of sorceries, who enslaved the nations by her prostitution and peoples by her witchcraft. Just as passing, the word peoples in the Hebrew is families. And again, you can describe that as families as far as nations. Or again, we go back to the basic institutions. Family is a foundational institution. And they are using the peoples, the nations, the institutions that God has established and trying to lure them in for their benefit and control, and also sorcery to control the people. So again, it's a way of looking at the Tower of Babel that the people were supposed to disperse and go off and have their own nations and cultures. Assyria is a beast that is risen up. Again, it's not one of the beasts of Daniel's vision. It's not one of the beasts necessarily, although we can make the connection in Revelation. But what you're seeing is these conglomerations of nations or of peoples or of groups that come together and try and control more than they're allotted are beasts. Like if you had the nation of Judah, that's not a beast, that's a nation. Or the nation of Egypt, that's not a beast, that's a nation. But when they start branching out and collecting, they become beasts with the many horns. And the beasts go from Assyria. Actually, Egypt became a beast in its own sense because it expanded tremendously. They goes historically from Egypt to Assyria, then to the four of Daniel's vision, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, and then to the final age, the final beast of the age of the Antichrist. But this is what they're going to use, prostitution and sorcery, to lure the people in and to actually use them for their own benefit, put a spell on them. And we'll talk about that more. So that's what they've done. The first verses 2 and 3 describe the invasion. Verse 4 is explaining why this had to happen to them. And now in verses 5, 6, and 7, God making his announcement, I am against you, declares the Lord Almighty. And again, you can see that's Yahweh Almighty. I will lift your skirts over your face. I will show you the nations your nakedness and the kingdoms your shame. I will pelt you with filth. I will treat you with contempt and make you a spectacle. All who see you will flee from you and say, Nineveh is in ruins. Who will mourn for her? Where can I find anyone to comfort you? Now that again is being written around 645 at the peak of their power, and in a matter of 645 to 612, it's going to have taken place, and there's nothing left. So God is speaking against, and they're going to actually bring them down. I'll show you the destruction they're brought to. Go to the notes, please. Just that first verse there at the top, chapter 3, verse 1. Woe to the bloody city full of lies and plunder, no end to the prey. And it's described right there, four descriptions. The bloody city, it's full of lies, full of plunder, and prey, full of their prey or their victims. That is what Assyria, that's one of their forms of their economy. The way they made money was to go off and deceive. I'm going to show you a couple of Bible verses. Went off and deceived. They'd make promises to nations, we will do this for you. But actually they were serving as a prostitute, making promises. And the prostitute sometimes would be thought of as serving someone, but actually the prostitute is using someone else to serve their own purpose. They're the ones that are getting the profit from the deal. And this person they're using is actually the victim. Same way sorcery is going to be used to manipulate and draw people in. And so the city, Nineveh, is a city of produces blood. It's full of lies. You can't trust Assyria. Full of plunder and full of prey or victims, meaning that the people they've captured. And it's interesting to take this right here. Again, we're looking at it history. But you'd have to imagine there are nations or cultures or empires today that are based on this very thing. They want to come across with peace treaties or deals, or they're here for the benefit of the people. But in reality, all they're putting forward is lies. They themselves are full of blood because they're destroying people, but it's being covered up. It's being some kind of propaganda. Some kind of promises are being made for the benefit of the whole, and there's actually behind the scenes this kind of destruction going on. Going into the Knicks now, the destruction, of the city. This is right. There's a list of four. There are four descriptive declarations, and you can see I've got chapter 2, verses 3 through 7. Chapter 2, verses 8 through 13 are the first two. This is the third description of Nineveh's coming fall. It's almost as if it's an eyewitness, almost like an eyewitness watching from the wall right here of what they see taking place. Very similar to chapter 2. We saw the same thing. And here I'm going to read in the NI or the English Standard Version off the notes, chapter 3, verse 2. The crack of the whip, the rumble of the wheel, galloping horse, bounding chariot, verse 3. Horsemen charging, flashing sword and glittering spear. There are seven things right there that are described. We'll look at them in a little more detail. And that is followed then with, what's the result? Hosts of slain, heaps of corpses, dead bodies without end. They stumble over the bodies. So here comes the invading army coming in. And they come in like this description. What they're seeing, if you're standing here on the wall, you're watching this, you're seeing or hearing the crack of the whip, the rumble of the wheel, galloping horses, and then you're going to hear the bounding chariot. That's the chariot forces. Then you're going to the horsemen charging. That's the infantry. And then the flashing sword. That's the foot soldier. So you're going to have chariots. You're going to have the cavalry. They got two C's there. Chariots, cavalry, and then the infantry or the foot soldiers are coming in. And as they come, you're going to see just piles of bodies. They're just slaughtering people. As the infantry comes through, what they have to deal with is, right here, the piles of bodies. And that's described this way again. Hosts of slain, heaps of corpses, dead bodies without end, and the bodies. That's all mentioned there. So again, it's the way it's written, it's dealing with speed. It's dealing with totality. There's nobody left. They're just slaughtering people. Now, the description here, if we break this down, the sound, first, it would apparently be the chariots. The first four identifies the chariot forces or the chariot teams. The crack of the whip, the rumbling of the chariot wheel, the galloping horses, and the bounding chariots. You can hear the sound coming, and as you hear the sound, finally you can start seeing the chariots coming. And the next would be the horsemen charging, the mounted troops that would accompany the chariots. This is even seen in Assyrian reliefs, where you've got the chariots in battle, and then around the chariots are going to be the cavalry, the soldiers on horses. The flashing sword, it was part of the foot soldiers' weaponry. Even archaeologist, I got it written down there, Yigael Yadon, he did a lot of excavation from Hazor to Masada. He did all kinds of excavations in Israel. But he says the sword was not part of the regular equipment of a mounted troop, the cavalry, or the chariot. So when it says flashing sword, that is talking about the foot soldier right here. So we're definitely talking about chariots, the cavalry, and then the foot soldiers. The spear, they say, would be used by any of you. See the spear being in a chariot. You see the infantry or the cavalry with spears, even the foot soldiers with spears. But they are described as flashing. Those are used, the sword and the spear are used for hand-to-hand in combat. So if you can imagine, we've already saw in chapter 2, the streets are just being rushing. Chariots are just rushing, flashing in the streets. And what they're doing, it looks like chaos from the wall here. But what's happening is it's a strategic surrounding the city. And with just in a matter of moments, the city is overrun and there's no route of escape. They are locked in and they can't escape. There's nowhere to go. This whole place is going to fall, like we know, in 3 months. But this initial attack, getting through the suburbs and getting around this wall here, was happening very quickly. The next thing in describing the dead bodies, go to page 2. where it says chapter 3, verse 3. Four times the dead bodies are mentioned in this verse. And there's three different Hebrew words that are used. And again, they're used, it's said quickly. And so it's just, I mean, things are happening so quick, so fast, the repetition. Just very quickly, as we look at these words, the host of slain is the word H-A-L-A-L, or casualties, and it refers to a person that is fatally wounded or pierced. If you look down, you can see this, if you wanted to take a look at it. At point three, I've got two verses. Chapter 2, verse 9 is written out in the interlinear, and then chapter 3, verse 3 is written out in the interlinear. I'm going to use that for an example, the two circled words. I'm going to show that to you in a minute for another purpose. But chapter 3, verse 3, you can find those words in there, H-A-L-A-L. I'm looking here if I can see it. It's the word right before the circle where it says, and a great number, the word right before that, of slain, a great number of slain. That is the word that refers to someone that has been fatally pierced or stabbed, some kind of a wound. The heaps of corpses is what's left behind by the advancing invaders. Corpses is the word you can see in the Hebrew, G-E-W-I-Y-A, if you took it over to the English. It comes from the root word gaw, G-A-W, which means back. So the heaps of corpses would refer to the back, or what they see is they just see piles of backs of people. So in other words, these are people that are just face down and just piled up face down. They've been running and have just fallen and they're piled up. So heaps of the backs of people just piled up. So it'd be someone that has fallen face down. And then the next is used twice, the word pager. And you can see that there on the way to the bottom line in that interlinear box to the right. It's a word that means carcass or bodies or someone who has collapsed from exhaustion. So, I mean, if you can imagine, some have been, the word is, they've been pierced. They've been hit with a sword. They've been cut down. Others have been killed and they're laying face down and just piled up bodies. Maybe people trying to get them out of the way, but just piles of dead bodies piling up on each other. And then there's some that have been running, trying to get out of the way. If you can imagine running, and not just jogging, but I mean running for your life. I mean, if they had to run for their life, if I had to run for my life, how far could I run? Now, I can go out and run, you know, 2 or 3 miles anymore. And I can, some days I can run, you know, pretty good pace for a 60-year-old. I can get down to, right around a 9-minute mile, you know, nonetheless. But I'm pacing myself. I'm running comfortably. And I can run, 2-3 miles without any trouble. Sometimes even a mile is trouble. But now if I'm running as hard as I can for as long as I can to get away from somebody, I mean, we're down to seconds now. We're down to, a minute, maybe a minute. I mean, and I imagine, again, that's a 60-year-old guy talking. But imagine just running from these chariots and the infantry that are trying to cut you down, and you're running as fast as you can, 1 minute, 2 minutes. I mean, you're not going to run 5 minutes at that kind of a pace unless you're an Olympic runner. You're just going to collapse from exhaustion and just get run over. So that's the idea. There's pierced, people that have been pierced, cut down with a spear or a sword, people that have been just fallen face down and run over by the chariots and just piled up in bodies, and some that are running trying to get away and have now collapsing. That's the description. So you describe the cavalry, or the chariots, the cavalry, the infantry, and then you describe what the result is. This place is just a sea of dead bodies. And this is being identified as by Nahum in prophecy, but it's as if they're looking from this wall, watching their city be overtaken. Now, point two, it says they stumble. It says, I'll read chapter 3, verse 3 again. Horsemen charging, flashing sword and glittering spear, hosts of slain, heaps of corpses, dead bodies without number. They stumble over the bodies. In other words, the military, there's so many dead bodies, they're having trouble not with the enemy at fighting back. They're having trouble wading through all the dead bodies. Their biggest challenge is all the bodies. That's the description of the invasion and destruction of Nineveh. Prophetically. Point three now, we're going to look at those two examples. The word heaps, where it says heaps of corpses or heaps of bodies. That is the word, and you can look down there. Well, I'll just read it. Is the Hebrew word K-O-B-E-D. And again, this is just interesting. K-O-B-E-D. And you can see that circled on 3B, where it says chapter 3, verse 3. I've got that circled. It's kobed, and it's a form of the word, kobed, describing heaps of corpses or piles of corpses. It's translated heaps of corpses or piles of corpses. Now, that same word, and it is the same word, it's just a different form of the word being used in that sentence, is used in chapter 2, verse 9, and I've got that right there, 3a. You can see the word written there again, K-A-B-O-D, it's the same word. It translates wealth. So that word is translated in chapter 2 as the wealth of Nineveh, the wealth. And that same word, now you've got wealth is being used over here. You could say the wealth of dead bodies. But of course, that's not a good wealth of dead bodies. They translated heaps of dead bodies. So it's the same thing. In one case, it's the wealth that has been taken from the nations that have been brought in as plunder. Now that same word in chapter 3 is now, what is it? What is your wealth now? Your wealth is bodies, dead bodies. Here you have the plunder of the nations, and now that whole thing is switched. Now your greatness, the vastness that you've got, your heap, your wealth is the dead bodies just piled up. And so it's a very clear, you know, connection there apparently. Of in one case, they've stolen the wealth and brought it to themselves, and the result now is this judgment. Chapter 3, verse 4. And all of this for the countless whoring of the prostitute. Why is this whole battle taking place? Because of the prostitute. And Assyria now is described as a prostitute. And again, I'll make some connections here. You may just read it generally and have, you know, just understand it that way. But there's a couple things I want to draw out of this. And all for the countless whorings of the prostitute. First of all, Nahum is being very, very coarse, very graphic. He's being very, he's not writing like a churchman. He's not writing like Sunday morning pastor. He's writing, if you want to think about, I mean, I don't know, some kind of chorus comedy club, and sometimes you have to shut videos off. They become so obscene. That's more of the flavor, if I can say it that way. He's being very negative. He's attacking Nineveh, and he's not. It's not like, oh, you poor people, you bad people, you're going to make God angry. He's taking them down and dragging them through the dirt using the most coarse language he can. And so as we read this in English, here in the English Standard Version, this is not polite language. And all for the countless whorings of the prostitute, graceful and of deadly charms. We'll look at that word in a moment. Graceful and of deadly charms. And that's important. The whoring of the prostitute. And she's going to be described as the prostitute of prostitutes, the whore of whores. And then it says, graceful, and of deadly charms. And that is what it is. You come across as graceful, you whore of whore. You graceful, but you're deadly. And that's exactly what it is. They come across graceful, but the result is death. Now, death to their victim, but also is going to result in the death of the prostitute. And all for the countless whorings of the prostitute, graceful and of deadly charms, who betrays nations with her whorings and peoples with her charms. And two things are being brought out here, is the prostitute, the whoring, I'll just say prostitute again, and then the charms, which is the word sorcery. Two things are being used here. The prostitute is trying to manipulate the victim. The sorcery is trying to put a spell and control the victim. They are looking for a victim. If they need to get the victim through prostitution, this is the victim. If they're going to get it through a sorcery, demonism, they're going to get the victim. The victim is going to pay the price. Now, if they have to come at them with graceful luring, they're going to get the victim. If they got to come at them with deadly charms and sorcery, they're going to get the victim. If you won't go for the trap of the prostitute, well then, we'll get you with demonism, sorcery. And again, this is talking about a nation. We can learn from it. We can think about it. We can fear God for it. But you can also try and reflect somewhere in our culture, somewhere in our world, our international relationships. I would guess some nation is doing this. Some empire is doing this. Some political group is doing this. They're coming across graceful. They're a prostitute. They're dressed up, looking good, giving you what you want. We're here to help you. Just like a prostitute, here to please you. But understand, you're the victim. Who's making the money in this deal? The prostitute. This is the winner. Oh, the poor prostitute. The prostitute's walking out with the cash. The victim has been stolen from. If that doesn't work, then we're going to use sorcery or demonism, and we're going to get you another way. If we can't lure you, we're going to cast a spell and bewitch you. That is what is being said. And that is what, well, look at what it says right here. Chapter 3, verse 4, the bottom of page 2. This whole invasion on Nineveh is because of this. And all for the countless whorings of the prostitute. Because you, Assyria, treated the other nations this way. You saw that they had something you wanted. So you went ahead and you dressed up as a prostitute, promising them things, but you're actually using them like a victim. And if that didn't work, you bewitched them with sorcery and demonism to draw them in. And so this is why those chariots are rushing through the streets, the dead bodies are piling up, and the whole empire is coming down, is because they practice this. Again, the principle remains true. If it's Egypt, if it's Persia, if it's Syria, if it's Babylon, if it's the kingdom of the Antichrist, this language is also used in Revelation to describe Babylon, Babylon the Great. Remember that you've got the prostitute riding the beast. You're going to have a similar situation here. This is going to get judged. If there are people today acting this way, if it be a nation, a government, an empire, a political party, if they're acting this way, they're bringing judgment on themselves. Yeah, they're destroying their victims. That's one story. But they themselves are going to fall prey. This is one of those stories where what goes around comes around. It's divine judgment. You may be winning for a while. Look at this, the chart. I mean, Shalmaneser, Shargon, Sennacherib, Esarhaddon, Hadan, then Ashurbanipal. All of them were doing this very thing. You know, skinning people alive, piling up heads, impaling people, all these things, wicked things. They controlled everything. Nothing could stop them. But eventually their day is going to come. Turn to page 3 on your notes. And there I've got, let's go ahead and read through the notes. Point 1, again, nothing new here, but the prostitute uses her attraction to lure people for her own personal gain. The person paying the prostitute may think they're being served, but they are the victim serving the interests of the prostitute. So again, the victim here, they think they're getting the advantage, but actually they're the victim serving the self-interest of the prostitute. Assyria, they're going to come to the nations. I'm going to show you. They went to Ahaz. Ahaz falls for this, King Ahaz, during Isaiah's day, right here. Hezekiah's father falls for this. They come and promise him things, and Isaiah says, don't do it. Don't do it. And Ahaz mocked Isaiah, mocked Isaiah's God, and went to Assyria and paid the price. As soon as they've got Ahaz on the hook, Hezekiah spends his whole time trying to figure out how he's going to pay Assyria's tribute, annual tribute. He was under bondage, eventually just sending gold from the temple to help pay the tribute to the Assyrians. Now, then that, again, that's just Judah's situation. They did this to all the nations. Likewise, Assyria, the empire, lured nations by providing them a service, but in reality, the nations were serving the attractive Assyria for Assyrian interests. I mean, obviously, in negotiations, there has to be give and take between nations, but Assyria had no intention of giving anything. They gave the impression they were going to give, but they took it. The person paying the price is always the victim and will face fatal consequences. Here we have right here, go to, if you would, I've got it written down here. Well, I can read it right off the paper. We can go to 2 Kings. I might have you go somewhere else, but right here, 2 Kings chapter 16. I'm reading it off the paper. So Ahaz is in trouble. Now remember, we know the story. Ahaz, this is the northern kingdom of Israel is still in place. They're still functioning. And they have joined with the Arameans or the Syrians to the north to fight against the Assyrians. And so they're got a little conspiracy going during Hosea. He was put in place by the Assyrians, but they saw weakness and they tried to join up with the Arameans. And they decided what they were going to do, Israel and the Arameans, they're going to come down and attack Judah and take Ahaz off the throne and put their own guy on the throne. That's Isaiah chapter 7 gives the details. So Isaiah went and tells Ahaz, don't do it. These guys are going to pass away. The Assyrians are going to destroy these people before you even have a chance to worry about it. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. Ahaz will have nothing to do with it. So Ahaz goes to the Assyrians, goes to Tiglath-Pileser, and says, hey, I need help. I need you to do me a favor. I need you to attack Israel in the north and the Arameans. And you can see right here, that's Tiglath-Pileser carrying off the gods of the Arameans right there. And there's the dead bodies piled up at one of the invasions that Tiglath-Pileser had. And Ahaz is like, yay, go. And he thinks he's got the Assyrians working for him. He's got made a promise. And we'll cooperate. And as soon as they got done, Isaiah even says, you've hired a razor. You've hired a razor that's going to come and shave you. He's not just going to shave the Israelites. Once he gets through with the Arameans, goes into Israel in the north, where is he going next? He's coming here. Ahaz says, no, I've got a treaty with the prostitute. And it's like, don't be stupid. And he was. And here it is, right here, 2 Kings chapter 16. So Ahaz sent messengers this is right out of the Bible, to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and rescue me from the hand of the king of Syria, or the Arameans, and from the hand of the king of Israel, who are attacking me. Ahaz also took silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house and sent a present to the king of Assyria. And the king of Assyria listened to him. The prostitute listened to Ahaz. Oh, don't feel sorry for the prostitute. The prostitute is a prostitute for profit. And the king of Assyria listened to him. The king of Assyria marched up against Damascus and took it. That's what we see right here. This is their monument of what they did to Damascus in the area. Carrying its people captive to Kir and killed Rezin. When King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser. So Ahaz meets Tiglath-Pileser. King of Assyria, he saw the altar that was at Damascus. Can you say witchcraft or sorcery? You're now in paying the prostitute. Now you're going to get into their sorcery, their demonism. He saw the altar that was at Damascus. And King Ahaz sent Uriah the priest a model of the altar. He says, you mind if I take some measurements right here? Tiglath-Pileser, can I measure your altar that you've got set up here in Damascus? Because I want to have the same thing. This works so well for you. I would like to worship and get in the same demonism you're involved in and have the same success you're having. So he sends a model to Uriah the priest, the Levitical priest in Jerusalem, serving in the temple in Jerusalem, gets a model and the plans of the Assyrian altar. And the king of Assyria sent to Uriah the priest a model of the altar and its pattern, exact in all its details. And Uriah the priest built the altar in accordance with all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Uriah the priest made it before King Ahaz arrived from Damascus. So when Ahaz gets back from meeting Tiglath-Pileser in Damascus, he comes to Jerusalem, and you can read on that account. He goes, oh, perfect. It looks just like the one I worshipped on in Damascus with Tiglath-Pileser. And he goes into the Temple Mount and worships on the Assyrian altar instead of the altar of Yahweh. That is the prostitute and the witchcraft that was coming in. Now, Isaiah 36, 16 through 17. Just another example. This is Sennacherib now coming up here. We're going to come back to this. But Sennacherib now in 701, and you know this account. There's a whole chapter. We got the whole letter. But Sennacherib's field marshal is now speaking to the people on the wall in Jerusalem. And he says, do not listen to Hezekiah. Hezekiah now, contrary to his father, Ahaz, was listening to Isaiah. And he was telling the people, we're going to trust God. We don't want anything to do with the prostitute. We're not going to join the Assyrians. We're going to stand against the Assyrians. So now, Sennacherib sends his messenger, the field marshal, to the wall of Jerusalem and is reading a letter. And this is what the prostitute says. Do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, make your peace with me and come out to me. Then each one of you will eat of his own vine, and each one his own fig tree, and each one of you will drink the water of his own cistern, until I come and take you away to a land like your own, a land of grain and wine, a land of bread and vineyards. Listen, don't just agree with me. Just come out to the prostitute. Just come out to me, and you can have your own home. You can have your own well. You can have your own vine. And I'll let you stay here until I'm ready, and then I'm going to take you to a new home. A new home that will be just like your old home, where you're going to have a house and vineyards. You'll have your own tree. You'll have your own stuff right here. It will be free. Just trust me. I'm the prostitute. You can trust me. And all the people were like, Hezekiah, this sounds like a good deal. They're promising us all these things. All we've got to do is give them our stuff, and it will all work out. And this is nation after nation. Now, I've got to go to this. Well, yeah, let's go to 2 Chronicles. I've got it written right there. I just want to see what else is written in there. 2 Chronicles chapter 28. Now we're going back to chapter 28 of 2 Chronicles. We're going back now to Tiglath-Pileser and Ahaz. We first read about Ahaz going up to Damascus to meet with Tiglath-Pileser after he hired him to fight the Israel, northern Israel and the Arameans. Then we jump to Hezekiah, whose people were being told, just trust us. We'll give you all this stuff free. Just come join us. Now we're going to go back to Ahaz, and Ahaz is now, he's involved. He's fully involved. He's got the altar. He's paid the tribute. He's got, the prostitute has done the work. He's destroyed northern Israel. He's destroyed the Arameans, carried off their gods. Ahaz has gotten full service from the prostitute Assyria. And now everything's going to be beautiful. They're going to live happily together forever. 2 Chronicles 28, verse 20. Let's go to verse 19. The Lord had humbled Judah because of Ahaz, king of Israel, for he had promoted wickedness in Judah. How had he promoted wickedness in Judah? Chapter 28, verse 19. Well, he brought the Assyrian altar down, amongst other things. Promoted wickedness in Judah and had been most unfaithful to the Lord or to Yahweh. But not to worry, he's forsaken Yahweh, but he's got a covenant with Tiglath-Pileser, the Assyrian prostitute. Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came to him, but he gave him trouble instead of help. Ahaz took some of the things from the temple of the Lord and from the royal palace and from the princes and presented them to the king of Assyria, but that did not help him. So he says he'd already sent him. Now this is again, this is the promise that the field marshal of Sennacherib was making to Hezekiah's people. But now we go back to Tiglath-Pileser and Ahaz, and Ahaz sends him money to do a service. Tiglath has come down and destroy the Arameans and the Israelites. Very good. He does that, takes them captive and disperses them, or begins the dispersion of the northern Israel. And then he comes down and he meets with Ahaz. And Ahaz is all, yay, this is my friend Tiglath-Pileser. I've paid him money to do this work for me. He works for me. He's the prostitute. No. The prostitute is the one walking away with the money. You're the victim. Oh, no. I can trust Tiglath-Pileser. I've given him these things. We're going to work together. So Tiglath-Pileser comes, and again, I'll read it. It says, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came to him, but he gave him trouble instead of help. Ahaz took some of the things from the temple. Now, he's already paid for the services. So I don't owe you anything. I've already paid. You are a prostitute. Right. You're the victim. I know what you've got. I've taken these people out, and now there's nothing to defend you. So now I want some more. Ahaz took some of the things from the temple of the Lord and from the royal palace. And he can't, it's not like the Assyrians are going to give the people homes and vineyards and wells. They promised that, but now they promised them that, and the people bought into it. But now they come from the royal palace, from the temple, they take stuff, but also they had to take stuff from the princes and presented them to the king of Assyria, but that did not help him. In other words, he's taking stuff, more stuff, and giving it to the king. Eventually, you're going to see this in other places, they're going to have to take stuff from the common people. They're going to have to tax. That's what Israel ended up doing. Northern Israel ended up taxing everybody. Every man that had a field had to bring money and give it to the king, Hoshea, to give to Shalmaneser. And so they're tagged. We've given them all the gold in the palace. We've emptied the temple. There's nothing left. But you people. You people have to bring the king money because we've got to pay Assyria. I mean, does this sound familiar? In his time of trouble, King Ahaz became even more unfaithful to the Lord. Now, that'd be a good time to turn to the Lord. He offered sacrifices to the gods of Damascus who had defeated him. For he thought, since the gods of the king of Aram have helped them, I will sacrifice to them so they will help me. But they were his downfall. And then the gods they are talking about right here are these gods right here. These are the gods that are being taken by the Assyrians. He's like trying to tap into their deities to help him. Ahaz gathered together the furnishings from the temple of God. Now this is again another wave. And took them away. He shut the doors of the Lord's temple and set up altars at every street corner in Jerusalem. And he's trying very hard to be very spiritual. He's full force into demonism. In every town in Judah, he built high places to burn sacrifice to other gods and provoke the Lord of God, his fathers, to anger. And he goes on and talks about those things. The key verse being, Tiglath-Pileser came to him, but did not bring him help. Instead, brought him trouble. And again, the idea there was the more that was Tiglath-Pileser, and these kings have figured out, the more we oppress people, the more money we're going to make. There's nothing that can figure it out. If you have it's a monopoly. They've got a monopoly on the Middle East. It's like, well, we need some more. Tell them to bring us some more. They're taking the trees out of Lebanon. They're all the way across into Cyprus, taking stuff from Cyprus. They're just, whatever they want, they're taking. That's what they're described. The place is full of plunder. Okay. So that's what we're looking at right there. Again, this is that verse. Because of this kind of prostitution that they're doing, they're self-serving. Point two, in the end, in 612 BC, both the nations lured by Assyria and the Assyrians themselves had their life drained away because of this practice. The Assyrians, who were coming against the nations, challenging the nations, to make them pay them more money. These nations lost, their life was drained from them. But because of the practice of the Assyrians are going to have their life drained. They're going to destroy. Both the prostitute and the victim are going to be destroyed. And we've already seen the nations destroyed. Now the Lord is going to destroy the Assyrians. Now, I've got up there circled two words. The two words that are circled up there are the same word. You can see the words within there. There, the words are the same in the Strong's. They're 3785 Keshef, and they mean sorcery or witchcraft. And so they're using definitely witchcraft in this whole process. You can point this out. You can see, we saw it in the English Standard Translation, point four. Nahum calls Nineveh the whore of whores, A. B, a charming, well-dressed lady. And that is the phrase in the Hebrew, Tobat Hen, is literally fair of grace. And that's what we pointed out. She was the fair lady, but also demonic. Promising love and cooperation, but is in reality a demon in witchcraft. And we could go to Revelation 18 and read more about that there. And now here we come with verses 5, 6, and 7. And this is God's words against Nahum. God's words through Nahum against the Assyrians. What we saw so far tonight was, one, the invasion. Why the invasion? Because of the prostitution and the witchcraft, or the sorcery that they've used and destroyed the other nations. And now God is going to say, this is Yahweh's response, He's going to say, because this invasion is happening because of this, and this is because I am against you. He's going to destroy them. Here it is. I'm reading chapter 3, verse 5, 6, and 7 on page 4. Behold, I am against you, declares the Lord of hosts. That's a frightful thing. I mean, He is the Lord of all the gods, all the demons, all the angels. He's in charge of all of it, and He's against you. And He describes, again, it's going to be as shameful as the words that were describing them as a prostitute. I will lift up your skirts over your face. I will make nations look at your nakedness and kingdoms at your shame. I will throw filth at you and treat you with contempt and make you a spectacle. I mean, you can't say anything more vulgar than those things is what He's going to do. Because you have done this and you've destroyed people and you've mistreated nations and families and countries, you've been lying, you've been shedding blood, you're so great. You've got all these monuments to yourself. Here's Ashurbanipal. He's fighting lions. And here's Sennacherib and his father Sargon and all the monuments. They've got these Lamassus that they've got these human-headed lions with wings, kind of like some kind of cherubim. They're great monuments to themselves. Now God says, these people that are great, I'm going to lift your skirts up over your face. The nations that you've plundered are going to look at your nakedness, meaning you're now powerless. You are nothing left of you. They're going to go, there's nothing here. I will throw filth at you. Not only are you going to be standing naked with nations staring at you, I'm going to throw filth at you while you're standing there being stared at by the nations. I'm going to throw filth at you and treat you with contempt and make you a spectacle. People are going to come out just to see this. This is so disgusting. This is so absurd. This is so ridiculously rude, crude, corrupt that people will just come out and just say, I got to see this. God said, that's how I'm going to treat you and make you a spectacle. And all who look at you, when they do see it, will shrink from you and say, wasted is Nineveh. It's like, well, how bad is this? Take a look. It's like she's naked and everyone's staring. The Lord's throwing filth at her, making her a spectacle. It's like, let's see it. And they look. It's like, oh, no, I wish I hadn't seen that. I can't forget what I just saw. That's the way the nation's going to look at Nineveh. Wasted is Nineveh. Who will grieve for her? Where shall I seek comforters for you? It's like, there's no one's going to come to your funeral. You're too rude to everybody. You were a prostitute. You used witchcraft. You just used people for your own advantage. And now, yeah, at one point you were impressive. You were great. You were at the top of your game. And people just honored you because out of fear. But now you're naked with your skirt up over your face with filth being thrown at you, being a spectacle. It's like, I don't think anyone's going to come. They used to come just out of fear. They didn't like you, but they just were scared of you. Now they're going to be scared of you. It's just disgusting. Yeah, no one's going to show up. No one's going to be here. That is what God is saying to Nineveh. Now, I've got six more points I want to read to you on what took place. First, Sennacherib threatened Jerusalem. I began with this in 701. So right here, at the height of their power, 701, at the height of their power, they're still rising. Ashurbanipal's still strong. And for 20 years, Ashurbanipal, from 668 to, say, 648, about the time Nahum's writing, he's still making these monuments to himself. But about 648, 645, 630, they go into decline. So if you want to say 630, the decline set in. From 630, let's just say 640, because that's a good year. And so that's right in the middle of Ashurbanipal's reign. They're still at the peak, but they're so corrupt that from 640 to 612, I mean, in less than 30 years, we're talking, that's what, 28? Is that 28 or is that 38 years? 38, 40 minus, that's 28. So, yeah, in 28 years, in less than three decades, they're going to go from the top to being total, and again, these last few years weren't like pleasant. I mean, they're like running, hiding, losing people, and they collapsed that quickly. It was very dramatic. The collapse of Nineveh, just on this chart, was dramatic. Now, here's some words. When Nineveh falls in 612, excavations show from 612, no one lives there, is not occupied for 300 years. So you're going to have to go down to 312 or something, 300 BC, before you find, it was laid waste and no one settled there again. It's gone. I mean, you can see on the map, it's a great city in 640. It's still a city by 627, but by 612, it's gone. And it's gone for 300 years. It never comes back. Xenophon. Now, you may not know who Xenophon is, you know. I got the word spelled wrong. It's supposed to be the Athenian-born military leader, philosopher, and historian that was elected to command 10,000 Greek mercenaries going through that area when he was 30 years old. So in 400 B.C., see, this is 312. No one's going to occupy it in 312. Right around 400 B.C., so 200 years later, minus 200 years, the Greeks, one of the great Greek generals with 10,000 Greek mercenaries is marching through the area. He's writing history. He's writing philosophy. He marches right past Nineveh and doesn't know it's there. It's gone. He marches right, they can track him. He goes right past Nineveh. And in all of his, he writes all the history. He's commanding the military. And Xenophon didn't even see it. I missed Nineveh. Lucian, in 125, or let's say about 150 A.D. now, he's an Assyrian satirist, a rhetorician. He writes this. We're talking about 150 A.D. Nineveh has perished, and there is no trace left where it once was. So in 120, 150, living in the area, one of their famous writers goes, we don't even know where, we've heard of Nineveh, but we don't know where it's at. They're thinking it's a legend. Now listen, see this? These things right here are taken from Nineveh. All these wall plaques. I mean, I've seen them. You've seen them. You've seen pictures of them. They're just kept digging it up. But in 150, you tell them about this, they go, yeah, I don't know if that's true. It's like the city of Atlantis. It makes you wonder when you hear story again, not to be a conspiracy theorist, but you hear these stories and they say, no one's ever going to find Atlantis. Or what was Atlantis? That nothing. It's like, was Atlantis like a Sodom and Gomorrah at some point and it just was buried somewhere? And it's like, you're never going to find this. For example, or you hear these stories like, The legend of such and so, or the legend was this great city. It's a mythological city, legendary. It never really existed. But you got to go there because no one's ever found it. That's what Nineveh was within 300, 200, 300, 400 years out. It's a legend. It doesn't exist. It never existed. These people they're the some kind of Greek gods that they made up. Okay. Cambridge Ancient History says, no other land seems to have been sacked and pillaged so completely as was Assyria. Jerusalem fell, Rome fell, but not like this. And the final point, number six, one of Nineveh's excavators that actually excavated the site, that found these things. He says, we have been fortunate enough to acquire. Now, can you imagine being the archaeologist who's going to say, I want funding. I want university funding. I'm going to take a team and we're going to find Nineveh. Right, you're going to find Nineveh. And he goes over there and he finds Nineveh. With no doubt. I mean, they can read the inscriptions. And these inscriptions line up with the biblical account. One of Nineveh's excavators wrote, we have been fortunate enough to acquire the most convincing and lasting evidence of that magnificent and power which made Nineveh the wonder of the ancient world, and her fall the theme of prophets as the most signal instance of divine vengeance. This is the guy who dug it up. He says, the reason the prophets wrote about Nineveh was because there was never a more evident sign of divine intervention than Nineveh falling. Because it's a legend. But yet when we get there and we found it, it's like, who could forget this? And her fall, the theme of the prophets, as the most signal instance of divine vengeance. Without the evidence that these monuments afford, meaning without having found these monuments, we might also have doubted that the great Nineveh ever existed. So completely has she become a desolate and a waste. That's the guy who dug it. He said, we hadn't found these. He says, we'd have to agree too. It's a legend. But we found it. And there these things are. That's just amazing when you think about that, how powerful they were. And at this point in history, Nahum is writing saying, you're going to be forgotten. And sure enough, that's exactly within, almost instantly, within 200 years, they couldn't find it. They didn't know where it was. And just a tribute to that and kind of a humbling thought. We're going to continue with this next week. I appreciate you being here. Nineveh the Great. The book of Revelation talks about Babylon the Great. If it's not here, it's another one's coming, another great empire that's going to try to reduplicate it. And God's going to let them run their course. He's going to use them for his benefit to purify the saints and bring in everlasting righteousness. But Babylon the Great, which apparently should be rising in history at some point again, if it's the literal Babylon, if it's rebuilt Rome, if it's something we can't even imagine, it's coming again, and it will do. This is going to be repeated. This will be repeated. The oppression, the arrogance, the prostitution, and the demonism over nations, and its total collapse. There will be persecution of the righteous in the coming kingdom of Babylon that's going to simulate the role of Assyria. I'll pray, and you're free to go. Father, we thank you for your truth. We thank you for your word, and ask that we would again be able to analyze our lives, analyze our history in light of what is going on in the scriptures, and be able to trust you in the darkest hours when we see the rise of Nineveh or we see the rise of wickedness. We ask that we would be able to avoid the lure of the prostitution and the demonism and walk in light and righteousness as you have called us to, and wait for your glory to appear. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.